The Federal Bureau of Investigation, regardless of your current feelings about it, is an American institution. It wasn't always. We get a reminder of its history in this interview from 2015. There's a certain level of cinematic romanticism attached to bad guys in American history. I mean, just listen to the names, Billy the Kid and Babyface Nelson. The names themselves are almost cute. Maybe we just romanticized the criminals of other times because they were certainly plenty scary when they were active. Author Joe Urschel makes that clear in his book about 1933 called The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. Joe Urschel is now executive director of the National Law Enforcement Museum in Washington, where he was earlier the executive director and one of the founders of the Newseum. His long journalism career includes several positions at USA Today, including as managing editor. Joe Urschel, welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you.
So your career has been very much about today's news. What got you focused on 1933?
Well, my focus turned to 1933 back in 1982, oddly, when I just arrived here in Washington, D.C., and I went up to the Library of Congress, which is one of the great buildings to visit here in Washington, and I went into the reading room, and they had just converted their card index system over to an electronic database. This is early in the digital revolution, I guess. And just kind of on a lark, I went over and typed in my last name, which is rather unusual, and I've never met any other Urschels once I got outside of upstate New York where I was born. And one name came up, and keep in mind that the Library of Congress is supposed to be the world's largest collection of knowledge. And so one name comes up, and it's Charles Urschel, kidnap victim. And there's one book in the entire library about it. It was called Crime's Paradise, which was written in 1934, a year after the kidnapping. And it was written by actually the guy who paid the ransom. And so I called up the book, and I sat down and read it, and it was just like reading a Dashiell Hammett novel. It was this incredible story of this remarkable crime that occurred and was perpetrated by Machine Gun Kelly and other members of his gang. And I was just fascinated with it because, I'd heard of Machine Gun Kelly. I sort of thought I knew who he was. And J. Edgar Hoover, who was working at the Justice Department at the time, is charged with tracking him down. And, of course, everybody's heard of J. Edgar Hoover. But I had never heard of Charles Urschel, and it turns out that he is really the guy who's instrumental in solving the crime. And I was just kind of struck by the fact that I didn't know anything about this guy and his actions and what he did in a rather courageous fashion literally altered the shape of history. He, this case produced the largest manhunt in American history. J. Edgar Hoover's guys chased Kelly over 16 states and 20,000 miles. It resulted in a trial that was covered by covered every day by the press from here to Europe. I mean, the Europeans were fascinated with all the violence in America at the time. It was recorded on motion picture cameras and showed in movie theaters. It resulted in the launch of the FBI and the establishment of Alcatraz as a federal penitentiary.
And did you ever find out if you were related to Charles Urschel?
I did. You know, I went to, of course, I first went to my dad and I said, "Hey, do you ever heard of this guy? Are we related to him?" And he said, no, we're not. So like any good son, I decided to set out to prove my dad wrong and did all kinds of genealogical research and discovered that, there's no connection, at least going back a couple of centuries. If we are related, it goes back to the German Republic or even beyond. So at that point, I kind of gave up and just immerse myself instead into the story.
Yeah, you don't have to be related to Charles Urschel to appreciate. You know, I almost found myself saying that he was the right guy in the right place at the right time. But when you get kidnapped, it's hard to think that. But if you're going to have somebody kidnapped, because of the way his brain worked, as we'll reveal as we go through the program, he was definitely the right guy to be kidnapped at that time. Before we go down the crime road, though, Joe, I mean, can you set out what other things were significant about that particular year in history, 1933?
Well, yes, 1933, I called it the year of fear because it's probably the worst year in American history since the Civil War. It is the worst year of the Depression. I mean, you've got unemployment rates in some cities as high as 80%. You've got industries are wiped out. The car industry is down. Everything is just decimated. And you've got the Dust Bowl beginning to kick up. And the Dust Bowl is an environmental tragedy that's almost hard to imagine. I mean, the dust storms were so thick down in Oklahoma and Texas, where this story takes place, that it would just choke the cattle in the field and blow all the way into New England and turn the snow red. And people had never seen anything like this before. And then in the midst of all this, you've got what was referred to as the criminal alley that stretched from Dallas, Texas to St. Paul, Minnesota. And all along that band, these criminal gangs were operating with virtual impunity.
So who would stop them? Enter the FBI. Joe Urschel is the author of The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. We'll rejoin the interview here on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 30. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Joe Urschel, once managing editor at USA Today, turned his journalistic focus backwards in time to one of the bumpiest years in American history for his book, The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. The Year of Fear was 1933. The Year of the Interview was 2015. Let's return to that interview now. So this book really starts with the so-called 3 a.m. phone call. That was actually 2 a.m., I guess, to J. Edgar Hoover, who at that time was not the strong figure we came to know in later years. What was the general status of Hoover and his operation at that time?
Well, he was sort of a man on the brink. He had been operating the Bureau of Investigation, as it was called then, and it was not... It was not at all a national police force. It was not at all well respected. His department was actually called the Department of Easy Virtue. It was considered kind of a patronage job, and the new FDR administration was just coming into office, and the first attorney general that FDR had appointed was a guy who hated Hoover, had a long and bad history with him, and had announced that he would be dumping Hoover as soon as he got to Washington. However, he died prematurely before he could actually get there, and the second appointment for Attorney General was a guy who felt Hoover might be able to do the job. The new Attorney General's name, Homer Cummings, he's a guy who really wants to help FDR prosecute this war on crime, and he's looking to the Justice Department to sort of set up a national police force, which the country did not have at that time. And he wants Hoover to do it, but he wants to see some results really quickly. A new law had just been passed, referred to as the Lindbergh Law, and it allowed the Justice Department's agents to chase kidnappers across state lines. And no other law enforcement agency actually had that authority. You know, most the state police forces, of which there were only 11 at the time, their jurisdiction obviously ends at the state line. County sheriffs end generally at the county line. So if you wanted to pull off a kidnapping, and in 1933 there were an awful lot of them. In fact, between 1930 and 1933, nationally there were about 2,000 successful kidnappings. The most famous of which was the Lindbergh case, which was still dragging on 18 months later when this kidnapping occurs. So Hoover is really desperate to solve this case, or to solve any case, really, and prove his worth. So when this kidnapping comes along, he throws all of his weight behind it. And the way these kidnappings worked, and the reason that they were so prevalent, was because Prohibition was coming to an end, and it being the worst year of the Depression, there wasn't much money left in the banks. So guys like Kelly, who made their livings basically by running liquor and robbing banks, found their sources of income drying up. So this new crime kind of hatched, which was called the snatch racket. And in this scenario, these guys would kidnap a wealthy individual, hold him for ransom, and then release him when the ransom was paid. Release him unharmed, with the threat that if you go to the authorities, we're going to come back and we'll kill you and your family as well. So very few people cooperated with the national law enforcement or even the local law enforcement at that time, until Charles Urschel comes along. And Urschel is kind of a tough character himself. He's, you know, he grew up on a poor farm up in the Midwest, and after World War One, he decided to strike out for Oklahoma and try to make his name and his fortune in the oil business, which he actually does. And at the time, he's the wealthiest oil man in the Southwest. And that's when George Kelly and his wife Catherine set their sights on him as a kidnap victim. He becomes part of their plan to kidnap five individuals, wealthy individuals, ransom them for $200,000 each, take the money, and live happily ever after in Juarez, Mexico. So so Urschel turns out to be the first guy they try to capture.
And let me just remind our listeners, we're talking to Joe Urschel about his book, The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. So let's pick up with Machine Gun Kelly. It sounds like he was not that tough a character until he spent time in Leavenworth, the federal prison.
Right. He was a guy, unlike most of the other gangsters of that era, especially out west, he grew up comfortably middle class in Memphis, Tennessee. His dad was a fairly wealthy businessman. He actually went to college for a semester. While he was in high school, he started his liquor running business when he caught his father in a tryst with another woman and went to him and basically blackmailed him, saying, "Okay, here's the deal. I won't say anything about this as long as you give me the family car and you underwrite my my liquor running business." At the time, Tennessee was a dry state and Arkansas right next door was wet. So he would jump in his dad's car, drive across the state line, pick up liquor, bring it back to the country club where he was a caddy, you know, sell it to all the members, and then basically started building his business there. And he just continued. After he dropped out of college, he just went back into that business after trying a few other things and not succeeding at it. And he ended up getting arrested for selling liquor on an Indian reservation, which is a federal crime. And so he ended up in Leavenworth Prison, where he meets all kinds of bad characters. But, you know, he's a smart guy. He's pretty good with books and numbers, and he gets himself a job in the prison front office, and he uses his position there to forge exit papers for various gangsters who he's helping to escape. And in return, they tell him, when you get out after your 3-year sentence here, and you want to get into business with us, look us up in St. Paul at the Green Lantern Tavern. And that's what he does. And they basically teach him how to rob banks, how to use weapons, and he takes off and starts this string of bank robberies with his partners from St. Paul, but also eventually with his wife Catherine.
You could have written a whole book just about St. Paul itself. And so give us some idea of the interrelation between the criminal guys and the police departments in places like St. Paul.
Well, St. Paul was protecting itself with a very unusual system of law enforcement. So the mayor and the chief of police let it be known that criminals of all kinds could safely hide out in St. Paul as long as they didn't commit any crimes within the city limits. Whatever they did once they got out of town, they didn't care about. So consequently, you had huge collections of these gangs using St. Paul as safe haven, and then going out and plundering the countryside. I think in 1933, something like 25% of the successful bank robberies occurred within an easy drive of St. Paul, Minnesota. And you had similar kind of operations in other cities around the country, Kansas City, Joplin, Missouri, and places like that. But Kelly just ended up with the St. Paul mob, and that's what's basically sent him off on this life of crime.
Life of crime included the kidnapping of one Charles Urschel, the oil magnate, which is the central issue in the book, The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. Joe Urschel, no relation to the kidnap victim, is our guest. It's author on the Jefferson Exchange. So a scene change here. You mentioned Kansas City, and Kansas City is central to this one. The federal agents arrest a guy named Frank Nash. Who was he, and what was he wanted for?
Frank Nash was a legendary bank and train robber. He was an older guy. He and his gang they're credited with the last successful horse-mounted train robbery in the nation's history. But he was a big mover in the bank robbing business, and he had successfully escaped from prison, and Hoover was trying to get him back, and basically sent his agents to pick him up and bring him back to Leavenworth Prison, which they did, until they were marching him through the Kansas City's Union Station, where one of his very close friends, a professional assassin, and two assistants were waiting to spring him when they walked through the parking lot. So there are three federal agents with him, two Kansas City policemen, and then another law enforcement officer from Oklahoma. And they're walking. So they put Frank Nash into the car, and they get in. They begin to assemble in behind him, and the escape team comes around with their machine guns wielding and order the agents to put their hands up and release Nash. One agent grabs a shotgun and it discharges. And when that happens, the three machine gunners just unload their weapons into the car, killing four law enforcement officers and Frank Nash. And this became known as the Kansas City Massacre. It was a horrific crime at the time. And this was also a case that J. Edgar Hoover was trying to figure out and trying to solve.
It really presented an opportunity for him, though, didn't it?
It did. But he, these these are pretty tough cases that he's going to be going after. And the FBI at the time, believe it or not, was not a law enforcement agency that was weaponized. They didn't carry weapons.
I was really surprised about this part of it, yeah.
They were basically lawyers and accountants who would help with the prosecution of crimes that local police officers had made arrests on. But when this comes along, Hoover has got to figure out where to find some agents who know how to go up against these types of hardened criminals. And he looks around his agency of over 350 agents, and he finds about a dozen guys who are experienced lawmen and know their way around weapons and police tactics. And he takes them and he deploys them against the Kansas City Massacre crime, which occurred just 1 month before the kidnapping. And when the kidnapping comes along, he pulls them all off Kansas City and puts them on the Urschel case.
All right, so Charles Urschel, we established his money came from the oil business, and a bit of a ripple to our time because Cushing, Oklahoma, the center of that part of the oil industry, is still critical in the oil business. Until the oil strikes, though, it sounds like Oklahoma was totally destitute from drought. And how chaotic did society get in Oklahoma?
It was a bad scene, as you can imagine. The earth is drying up and blowing away. Farmers are getting pushed off of their land. They're being foreclosed upon. But then these oil guys come in and they strike oil, and that was about the one way you could hang on to your land, is if a guy like Urschel or his partners would come in and find a stake on your land, and then they would pay you a drilling fee, and so you'd be able to hang on possibly, especially if they found a lot of oil. And so guys like Urschel and his partner Tom Slick and various other local wildcatters, I mean, they were heroes to these folks, and So they were really interested when he ends up getting kidnapped.
Which raises the question, I'm going to remind our listeners again, we're talking to Joe Urschel about 1933, the Year of Fear, as his book title has it. Charles Urschel was a detail guy. I mean, his mind was able to wrap itself around a lot of fine detail, apparently. I'm just curious about what it was that you think that allowed him to leave himself open to the possibility of a kidnapping.
Well, He also was a guy who liked his money. I mean, he came from a fairly poor background, and he wasn't eager to give it away. He knew he might be fingered for a kidnapping, and he'd actually hired a guard, but he caught the guy sleeping on the job, so he fired him just days before this kidnapping occurs. He is playing cards late one night with another couple. They're playing bridge on the sun porch when Machine Gun Kelly kicks in the door with his partner Albert Bates and comes rushing into the sun porch and looks around, and Kelly is baffled because there are two men there, and he doesn't know which one is Urschel. So, you know, he waves his machine gun around and makes a lot of threats, and he says, "We're here for Urschel. Which one's Urschel?" And nobody stands up. And then finally, in frustration, he says, "All right, we're going to take you both." So they throw them both in the car, and they drive out of town. And at that point, Kelly realizes he should probably check the wallets of the guys and identify them from their driver's license, which he does. And he takes Walter Jarrett, who was the other guy, throws him out of the car, gives him $10 of his money back, and says, "Okay, you're free to go. Grab yourself a cab and go back to town." And then they take off with Urschel. They blindfold him and they stuff his ears with cotton and tape them over, and they drive him around in, you know, circuitous fashion for hours until the next day, when they bring him down to a farm in Wise County, Texas, just outside of Dallas, where Catherine Kelly's father-in-law owns a farm and runs it as kind of a hideout for gangsters on the run. So they've got Urschel down in Texas, but, you know, they kind of forget the fact that he's been an oil man down there for over a decade, and he knows basically every inch of land in the two-state area anyway, because he's got oil stakes everywhere. And he's also got this kind of photographic mind, and he's also really set out to get his money back and to lead authorities back to this farm so that they can be arrested and brought to justice. So he begins collecting all kinds of information. Even though he's blind and basically deaf, he figures out the size of the house they have him hidden in. By talking to his captors, he figures out how big the farm is. He knows what kind of animals are on it because he grew up on a farm. He knows what the water tastes like. He knows how many buildings are on the farm, what the postman's name is, what the local prostitute's name is. And he notices every day at 9:30 in the morning, a plane goes overhead, and at 5:30, it comes back in the other direction every day except one day.
The level of detail that Charles Urschel could track is prodigious and helped lead to his freedom. Joe Urschel, no relation, wrote the book The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. The interview continues on the Jefferson Exchange in a minute 20. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. We're spending this hour in 1933, the heart of the Great Depression and the year of a big crime wave in America. Bank robberies and more shocked and scared the public. Joe Urschel, no relation to kidnap victim Charles Urschel, covered the year in his book The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. There are calls from the original broadcast in 2015, but we can't take any new phone calls or emails today. Paul in Grants Pass is on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Joe Urschel.
Good morning. Absolutely fascinating and riveting story. I'm going to have to buy the book. This is great stuff. To put this in context, and I'm sorry to take you out of your narrative pace here, but this is the time of the Great Depression also. This is the time of Cooksey's army. This is when MacArthur and Patton rode the veterans down in Washington, D.C. with the cavalry, as I recall.
Yeah.
How many of the overseas World War One veterans wound up dropping into organized crime? Was it a significant number, and did that have an impact on how this crime wave evolved because of the military training? I'll take my answer off the air.
All right, thanks for that, Paul.
Sure. I don't know the percentage or whether it was large or not, but it definitely did happen. In fact, one of the characters we were talking about, Vern Miller, the professional assassin who pulled off the Kansas City massacre, he was a decorated World War One marksman. And when he came back to the States, he got a job as a county sheriff in South Dakota. But he got convicted of embezzling funds, went to prison for a short time, and when he came out, he decided to put his military training to other uses, and he ended up being one of the most feared assassins in the country. You know, he worked for Al Capone and basically anybody who wanted to put up money for a job. Urschel, on the other hand, had enlisted in the Army during World War One. Of course, he took a different course. And, you know, another interesting connection is that the machine gun, the Tommy gun, it was envisioned during World War One, and the gun manufacturers were trying to rush into that weapon and get it over to the guys in Europe because it was such an effective killing machine. But they never got it in time. But then it was perfected after the war, and of course these military trained gangsters took to it right away.
All right, so back to the case of the kidnapping. Charles Urschel, the oil baron who is kidnapped by Machine Gun Kelly's gang and is taking all these mental notes of the goings-on around the place in Texas where he's being held captive. But back to his home, his wife Berenice is left behind. She gets on the phone to J. Edgar Hoover. I mean, what motivated her to call him, and how'd she know to do so?
Well, she of course was really familiar with the oil business. She knew about the kidnapping scourge and whatnot. And J. Edgar Hoover was so eager to solve one of these crimes that he basically invented what was probably the first national crime hotline. He set up this special number that anybody could call and be put through straight to the Justice Department if they knew about a kidnapping or if they had been the victim of one. And he was so eager to get information that he had the line extended all the way to his house near Capitol Hill in Washington. And so Bernice, who had seen a story about this hotline in Time magazine just a few days earlier, as soon as she calls the local police, she pulls out her Time magazine, calls up the hotline number in Washington. They put it through to J. Edgar Hoover in the middle of the night. He picks up the line, sitting on his bed in his pajamas, we presume, and says, this is J. Edgar Hoover. And she says, this is Bernice Urschel, and I want to report a kidnapping. And he says, tell me everything you know. And so with that, the chase begins.
Now, she had received instructions from Kelly and his gang not to call the police, though, right?
Absolutely. I mean, they were not to do anything if they wanted to see Charles Urschel alive again.
And so why did she seek out not only the help of the police, but the help of this barely functioning quasi just getting started police force?
Well, she was the Urschels were great fans of FDR, and they were big political supporters, and they had a particular distaste for the criminality that was rampant throughout Oklahoma and Texas, and she just wasn't scared. I mean, she had grown up, she raised her kids in the oil fields and, used to hanging around with threatening characters, roustabouts and whatnot. So she was just simply not intimidated. She would have known that Charles would want her to do that, too, so...
And indeed she did. So you show bunches of newspaper headlines from the day. How sensational a case was this, even in a time when there was lots of other sensational stuff going on?
Well, that's one of the things that made this book so much fun to research, because the coverage was so intense. I mean, this is a time when large regional dailies are really coming into the fore in places like Dallas and Kansas and Chicago, New York, and nothing sells a newspaper like a good crime story. So they were on this. They were on this case from the very beginning, and the wire services were all over it. They were reporting every rumor, every sighting, and it just made it. I thought just such an exciting immediate read. And you had like. The British papers were sending their best reporters over. The first national radio news network had just launched, NBC, and they were covering it. For a 6-week period, it just captivated the nation's attention. And there was just a lot of great detail in these newspaper stories about it.
You know, I'd expect nothing different from a guy who was one of the people who started the museum to have this level of detail, though, about the fact that reporters were very aggressive in their way, and particularly their behavior with the crime scene at the station in Kansas City. It just boggles the mind.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And well, one of my favorite incidents, it shows you how intense the coverage was while he was on the lam, Kelly checks into a hotel in Biloxi, Mississippi, and he's walking out of the hotel on his way to dinner or something, and a newsboy is walking by hawking a headline that says, Machine Gun Kelly in Biloxi. So he doesn't even go back into his room to get his gun. He just goes immediately to the bus stop and moves on to the next town.
All right. So how did the kidnappers make contact with Bernice Urschel about making the ransom drop for her husband?
Well, they end up sending messages back and forth, again, through the newspaper, through the classified ads. and they make their demands. They make Urschel write a note, and they put his fingerprints on it, and they send it. So she collects $200,000 in $20 bills, and the Hoover's agents write down every number, and they take one of their business associates, and he makes the drop. And with that, the Kellys go off to St. Paul to launder their money. Albert Bates goes off to Denver, and Urschel is released. He goes back home where there's all kinds of law enforcement around. The lead agent from the Justice Department goes to him and says, you know, it's going to be really hard finding these guys. It's like finding a needle in a haystack. But let's sit down and talk about it. So Urschel does this data dump of information that he's collected, and they talk for 2.5 hours. And the agent says to him, well, you know, the haystack just got a lot smaller. They jump in a plane. They fly over the route that the airline pilot had flown crossing the farm. They spot it from the air. They put together a raiding party. Urschel insists that he be part of it, and not only is, but is sitting in the lead car with a sawed-off shotgun across his lap, ready to go after his captors.
Wow. This is some pretty amazing stuff. And how quickly were they able to move from Urschel's release and his data dump, as you put it, to the raid on the farm?
Well, they... it was just simply a matter of a few days, and they staged the raid. In fact, they got down there the night before, but they decided it was too dark, so they wait till the morning, and they come storming in at about 5:30 a.m. just at sunup, and they capture everybody involved in the kidnapping, several people who weren't. But the only people that are missing are the two kidnappers themselves and Catherine Kelly. So that's what begins the nationwide search.
The big manhunt. Tell us a bit about Charles Urschel's press conference back at the Sun porch where he was first grabbed. This is another interesting moment.
Well, he was first of all, you got to understand he's the guy that doesn't like the press at all. Huh. You know, most oil men don't. Because they don't like sharing their secrets or talking about their wealth or where they've got stakes in the ground, and he sort of blamed the newspaper coverage of his wealth and his marriage, where a lot of his money was discussed, for the fact that he ended up getting kidnapped. So he goes before the press. He has this press conference. You know, he's. His eyes are all red from the tape that had been covering them for 8 days, and he talks to them for about 45 minutes or an hour, lets them take a couple of pictures, but he doesn't give away any of the facts about the raid on the farm or where they think Kelly might be going. He basically is just. Starts trying to release as little information as possible, but enough clues that they can get the press to cover this in such a way that it might flush the kidnappers out.
All right, so he didn't really appreciate them, but he certainly wanted them to be an instrument of success in solving the case.
Exactly.
All right. So down to the end of the line here. I mean, how did Hoover make use of the success in solving the case?
Well, what he really did was he made sure that the trial was going to result in a lot of convictions with life sentences. So he immediately. Puts everybody on trial when he's finally got them. He's got a trial that's set up in Oklahoma City. He's got a judge sitting on the bench who's a personal friend of Charles Urschel, one of his hunting buddies, in fact. He's gathered in the newspaper press and the newsreel photographers from around the country and given them front and center. so that they can cover this thing. He knows it's going to be a lock, and sure enough, they have this melodramatic trial, produces all of these headlines, and Urschel, Bates, Catherine, everybody involved, Catherine's family, they all draw life sentences. And even some of the guys who were just laundering the money, you know, drew stiff sentences. And a guy that they had captured on the farm who actually had nothing to do with it, another bank robber who was hiding out there, a guy named Harvey Bailey, he ends up getting a life sentence for participating in the kidnapping as well. And then as soon as that trial's over, Hoover and the Attorney General go before the microphones, and they declare their first victory in the war on crime. And then they say that, you know, in order to keep these guys in prison, we're not going to send them back to the places that they've already escaped from. We're going to create a new prison for these irredeemable types, the incorrigible criminals, the worst of the worst, and it's going to be on Alcatraz Island. And with great hoopla, they basically announced the formation of this penal colony. And Kelly and Al Capone and every name criminal of the time ends up getting sentenced there, and he's in the introductory class.
You certainly picked a great year and a great case to focus on, because they really are central in a lot of ways to a lot of structures and institutions we know today. The book is called The Year of Fear, Machine Gun Kelly and the Manhunt That Changed the Nation. Joe Urschel from the National Law Enforcement Museum wrote it. Joe, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me on.